what I want to talk about this morning, moving on through this work, Gakudo Yojinshu, is the next section called The Necessity for Training for Truth. And we'll probably go on to the third section, The Necessity of Constantly Practicing the Way in Order to Realize Enlightenment. So again, the Gakudo Yojinshu is a work by Great Master Dogen, the founder of our tradition in Japan. And it's listed in Zen is Eternal Life as a chapter of Shobogenzo, but I think that it's actually an independent work. It's not usually formally within the Shobogenzo. It is really a kind of a nice encapsulation and instruction about, with some ideas about how to make Zazen successful, some ways to help our practice of meditation in daily life be successful, some characteristics to look at about practice, and some things that we can do to help to support our practice and help cultivate it. The first section is called The Necessity for the Desire for the Way, and that talks about the fundamental idea of what we call the way-seeking mind, the mind that seeks the way, the arising of bodhicitta, as its formal term in Sanskrit, bodhi meaning enlightenment, citta meaning mind, so the mind that seeks enlightenment. And the equation of bodhicitta, the mind that seeks the way, with the mind that sees through the world to the core of impermanence, sees that the core of the world is impermanent, and that sense that everything, while there are nice aspects to the world and unpleasant aspects of the world, everything, it has this characteristic of impermanence. And when we recognize that, it has an effect on us and makes us kind of begin to think, oh, there must be something more. There must be some other deeper kind of reality that we can take refuge in, something, some other characteristic that that gives us satisfaction beyond the transient satisfactions of the impermanent world. So that's an important theme and element throughout this particular work, Gakudo Yojinshu. And so I want to bring that up and remind us of that these next two sections. So Dogen says, it begins, when a loyal servant gives advice, its power is frequently far-reaching. When the Buddhas and ancestors give so much as only a single word, all living things will be converted. Only a wise king will take advice. Only an exceptional trainee will truly hear the words of the Buddha. If the mind cannot change from one side to the other, the source of transmigration can never be severed. Unless the loyal servant's advice is taken, the government of a country will show no virtue and wisdom in its policy. So again, the name of this section is called The Necessity for Training for Truth, and that is this section, that one paragraph. It's a fairly straightforward idea. If we can hear all the good advice there is in the world, but if we don't actually put that advice into practice, then there won't be a benefit from that. And so that therein is our necessity of training, of actually putting the teaching into practice. And simply put, to clarify that we are training for what is true. It's fairly straightforward. When the Buddhas and ancestors give so much as only a single word, all living things will be converted. This is a fairly kind of subtle and profound idea that I think is quite important and something to bear in mind as we, and to consider, to look at, to bear in mind, to contemplate over time as we consider our practice. When we take refuge in the Buddha, when we actually put the Buddha's teaching into practice, it has an effect on us immediately, but it also has an effect on the whole world in the sense that we are part of a web of interconnectedness. And even more profoundly than that, when we put the Buddha Dharma into practice, we begin to see the world in a completely different way. And it could be argued, it is the experience of some, that the world fundamentally changes because of our adoption of the Buddha Dharma, of our practice of the Buddha Dharma. We change our minds, and that changes the world in a kind of direct way that we can experience. It may be a small change, or it may be a large change, depending on what change we make in our mind. But it is a true effect. And we can, and to me that is a very important idea. When I consider, I don't know, my kind of orientation, and this was something we talked about in the first section, our normal orientation, and mine definitely, is to look at the external world, to consider my life in terms of externals, to think about how comfortable I am, how I get along with people, how people get along with me, how the world works in terms of other people getting along, whether there's violence in the world, whether there's peace in the world, all these different kinds of things. I consider, as I'm kind of basically oriented to consider as important. And a lot of times there is a kind of frustration that I encounter, which is that there's all this stuff going on out there which impacts me, which affects me, which affects the way that I live and lead my life, which I actually can't directly change in an overt or external way. I can't change who's in charge. I can't change what the tax structure is. I can't change whether people actually pay attention in school or educate themselves or anything like that, at least not in a very dramatic way. Maybe there are some people who can, but I think even that's has a fairly limited effect. But this idea that if I am to change my own mind, that will have an impact on the wider world, to me is a great relief. It is a great means of going forward in a positive direction. In other words, I can apply the Buddha Dharma to my life, I can apply practice to my life, and change my life in a positive direction, and that has a direct impact on the world around me. So, in other words, just by simply doing the practice, keeping the precepts, and doing what needs to be done, I'm actually having a significant effect on the world itself. And in a sense, that helps me to kind of cut loose my frustration, my frustrated desire to change the world from an external point of view. It helps me to say, okay, I am doing this thing which is helping the world, and I can let go of my ineffectual efforts to change things in an external sense, if that makes sense. And it is the case also that sometimes it may just be a single word of teaching from the Buddhas and ancestors that helps us to make a subtle change in our life. River Master Jiu said, and I think she's correct, that my experience is that she's correct in that the cause of suffering is a subtle matter. And when we look at our minds, whether we're in a particular situation, it is often the case that it is just a subtle shift in our attitude, a subtle shift in our kind of perception that will really make the difference in a situation between it being a positive situation, a workable situation, a situation that we can go forward in, from being a situation which is characterized by suffering, difficulty, strife, angst, and all that stuff. Oftentimes it's just a subtle matter. And we can see that subtle matter simply by being still, working on the precepts, letting go of our views, our opinions, and that sort of thing. And sometimes it is the case that the Buddhas and ancestors can just say, just a particular word one way or the other. And I remember talking to my teacher about my stepfather had developed throat cancer, and he was the sort of person who never went to doctors. He had the experience of going to a doctor's office once and fainting when he went into the doctor's office. They just for some reason terrified him, and being a kind of rough and ready guy, he didn't want to go through that anymore. So he just never went to doctors. And the upshot of that was that he developed throat cancer and put off dealing with it, really, until it was virtually too late. The tumor had grown in his throat to such an extent that he could no longer eat food. He had lost like 50 or 60 pounds, was really out of it, quite weak, and finally circumstances conspired to get him into a doctor's office, and he finally dealt with it. So he was in a critical condition, and they weren't clear about whether he was going to live through the situation. I was living at Shasta Abbey at the time and thought, I have a great deal of affection for my stepfather and wanted to go up there and see if I could help sort things out because there kind of were difficulties and stuff. And so I was talking to my teacher at the time about that, and he didn't say one way or the other, go or don't go. He just kind of said, well, you know, you really can't, something like you really can't, you know, fix it for everybody, you know. But really do what you need to do. And it was just a kind of a subtle thing, and it was really kind of a low-key conversation. And I went away from it and thought, yeah, he's right. I really can't fix the situation for them, and I can't take away the suffering of my family in this way. And it helped me to let go of my angst, and I decided then to not go at that time and wait and go at a later time when I could actually be of a greater assistance. And that worked out fine. Maybe that my family would have appreciated my help then, maybe not, I don't know. But in terms of my own mind, I felt much more grounded about my decision and much more clear about what would be good for me to do. So it's oftentimes just a subtle matter, just a small thing, a small change that we need to make. So then the next section, the necessity of constantly practicing the way in order to realize enlightenment. Most people think that one must study in order to gain wealth, but the Buddha teaches that training itself embraces enlightenment. As yet, I have heard of no one who became wealthy without much study, nor of anyone who became enlightened without undergoing training. Okay, so this is an interesting sentence. If we want to become wealthier, if we want to have any particular external condition that we want to cultivate, we need to be able to study that situation, learn how to make it come about, and then put what we learn into practice in order to make it come about. And truthfully, that's a fairly straightforward recipe for success in whatever thing we endeavor to do. We figure out what needs to be done, we study it, we implement it, and we make it happen. There's a few other factors involved, like luck, that are involved, but to a great extent, that's pretty much how it works in life. And on a certain level, that is also true in terms of training, in terms of our wish to realize enlightenment, or in terms of our wish to realize the way. We need to figure out what it is that we need to do. We need to implement that thing and then do that, you know, kind of sustain that until we realize our goal. The interesting thing about this sentence, however, is that there is a subtle aspect of it, of difference within the Buddhist, within Buddhist practice, within the, our tradition and the way that we practice Buddhism. And that is this idea that the Buddha teaches that training itself embraces enlightenment. And that's something that, that is something that we need to really be careful about, because it really underlies our orientation toward practice, and it really underlies our moment-by-moment experience of practice and how we bring enlightenment into our life. Instead of it being a goal-oriented process, okay, I want to become enlightened, what do I do? Sign me up, I'm going to do that thing, go through the steps and become enlightened. Well, what Dogen's saying is that by the very act of asking the question, what is enlightenment, and by the very act of engaging in practice, we are expressing enlightenment. And this is quite important as we go more into the subtle practice of the Dharma, in the sense that one of the things that we need to do in order to give expression to enlightenment is to let go of our pursuit of goals, to let go of our pursuit of having things be different, to let go of our pursuit of having enlightenment be, or our lives be, conformed to a particular external standard. And that changes how our life proceeds. When we cultivate that mind which is content, that mind which is still and mindful in the present, that mind which is not looking for some external solution to our particular condition at this particular moment, it changes how we are in that particular moment and increases our ability to be content, our ability to be, to find what is satisfactory in an unsatisfactory and discontent world. And it's true that there is enlightenment to be realized. There is realization. And so we must, if we want to know, to see this deeply, to know this deeply, we will need to practice. The more we practice, in a sense, I hate to make it into an economic equation, but in a sense, the more we practice, the more we put into practice, the more we get out of practice. And there is a truth to that. There are, of course, differences in training methods, differences between faith and understanding, between sudden and gradual, but enlightenment can only be realized as a result of training. Okay, so the two differences here that we can talk about, the difference between faith and understanding and between sudden and gradual. The difference between faith and understanding is that in faith, we hear about the Dharma, we hear the Dharma, we read about the Dharma, and we think, oh, it sounds like that's true. It sounds like there's some element of truth in there, and I think I want to go and find that thing that it's being talked about. And so we sit down to meditate, and we start to keep the precepts, we commit ourselves to the way, and we go forward. And with the faith that we will begin to realize and see that the Buddha Dharma is true, and that we will be able to prove it true for ourselves. This is faith. We haven't proved it true. And as we go along, there is a deepening understanding. We begin to see, oh, when I sit, I feel better. When I sit, I feel more grounded, or I feel that there's some value in that. There's some positive quality that I get from practice. That is the beginning of understanding. And there is also the fruition of understanding. There is the realization of enlightenment. There is the realization of the deeper truths of practice. And it just takes a certain amount of time for us to practice in faith until we can prove that true for ourselves. In the meantime, we are actually proving it true for ourselves, because practicing is the actualization of enlightenment, is the expression of enlightenment. And each one of us, I'm sure, over time has some confirmatory experience of practice. I mean, there's some reason that we continue to do this. It satisfies something for us. And that, again, is the growing understanding of what practice is about. The idea of sudden and gradual, those differences, there's a whole kind of history of the discussion between sudden and gradual, which I think I'll pass on going into, but you'll probably encounter it if you read about Zen in the Chinese tradition particularly. The ideas are, and I think we've talked about them before, but I'll say, are that there's an analogy, which is that analogy of the different types of light switch. Sometimes you have a light switch which turns, which is just a regular straightforward switch. It turns on the light and it goes from dark to light. That is sudden enlightenment. There is some kind of event, some kind of experience where we go along and we're not seeing clearly, and then suddenly something happens, a word from the Buddhas and ancestors, and bing, the light comes on and we see more clearly, more deeply. And then there is a gradual enlightenment. It's like the dimmer switch. And over time, we might walk through a particular room a number of times, and at first when we go through there, it's all dark and we can't see, but somehow, kind of walking back and forth in the course of our daily life, the light has gradually increased in the room. And it turns out that someone's been turning up the dimmer switch on the light in the room, and eventually the light is fully on in the room. And this is what we call gradual enlightenment. Yeah, it's my theory that both of those things are happening at the same time for many of us, or often they're mixtures. We're not usually just one or the other kind of person, but some people emphasize, you know, in their experience, one or the other way of doing things. And in a sense, it's not really up to us to decide. It's just kind of what we get in terms of whether we're a sudden or a gradual person. It is the case that with anybody who is has had a sudden enlightenment experience, a sudden awakening, a sudden turning on of the light, that is the result of years of practice beforehand. And just as it is the case that someone who has the dimmer switch sort of experience, it is the case that it is the result of years of practice beforehand. You might read about people who, like Daikon Enno, Huineng, was a fellow who's a woodcutter, completely illiterate, would cut firewood for people, happened to be in a marketplace, heard someone talking about the Diamond Sutra, and had an instant awakening experience which illuminated the Dharma for him. Well, you might say, well, there's a guy who didn't do practice beforehand. And maybe that's true, but one has the feeling that there was some great merit from probably former existences coming into play there. So I think we can pretty much have faith, again, that without much study, we won't gain wealth. Without much training, we won't gain enlightenment. It's pretty straightforward. Some means of study are shallow, others deep. Some are interesting and others boring. But treasure is derived from study, from much study. None of these things depend on the abilities of rulers or just plain luck. Yeah, even though I said luck earlier, in Buddhism there really isn't such a thing as luck. I mean, if you think about it, it's all has to do with the fruition of merit and what our effort is. We make offerings, we do good works, we train ourselves in the Dharma, and all of these things are creating merit for the future. This is how we create a positive life for ourselves by doing good actions, by training ourselves. If treasure is attainable without study, who is able to teach the way through which rulers learn to truly rule? If enlightenment can be realized without training, the teaching of the Buddhas cannot be perfected. And of course, those things are learnable, and the teaching of the Buddha can be perfected. Although you may be training in the world of delusion, it is still the world of enlightenment. Training and enlightenment are one thing. When we are training in faith, when we are training in the darkness of faith, then we are still training in the world of enlightenment. Even though things may not seem clear, even though things may be difficult, we're still training in the world of enlightenment. We're still giving expression to enlightenment. We can have faith in this principle. If you can understand that ships and rafts are but a past dream, you will forever leave behind the self-opinions which fettered you to the scriptures. This refers to the idea that here's another little subtlety, a little aspect. There is an idea that you can think about the Dharma and study it from the point of view of like reading the scriptures and embracing the ideas intellectually, and think that somehow that is training without actually putting those teachings into practice in our life, without actually sitting down and doing the hard work of doing Zazen practice. There's a great thing, Milarepa, a great Tibetan master, had a number of disciples, and at a certain point, you know, he was a really famous master. At a certain point, he said to his disciples, who were well advanced, that he had taught them everything that he knew how to do, except for one thing. And his disciples said, "Well, you know, what's that one thing?" And he turned around and picked up the back of his robe and showed them his behind, which was full of calluses. This one thing, you need to put it into practice and really deeply actually engage in meditation and study. In other words, really give expression to the Dharma. So, in terms of the scriptures, they're very useful. We make use of them, we recite them, we put them into practice. The important thing is that we put them into practice. Okay, we're not trying to get rid of them or say that they're not useful or anything. What we're trying to say is they are not the thing. Intellectual study is not what we're trying to get after. This is not the thing that will address the issue of the unsatisfactoriness of life. Okay, the thing that will address that is actual putting the teaching into practice. And they are ships and rafts. The scripture, our intellectual study, our former understanding, they are ships and rafts which helped us to get to where we are, so we can think about them with gratitude. Okay, but because they're part of the past, they are part of a dream, basically. The past becomes a dream. The Buddhas do not force you. Everything comes out of your own efforts in the way. When you train, you are beckoning to enlightenment. Your own treasure is within you, not outside. Training and enlightenment are their own reward. Enlightened action leaves no sign by which it can be traced. This is one of those sections which I have kind of marked in my book to remind me. This is one of those great little encapsulations, I think, that Dogen makes, that really kind of points something of value to me. The Buddhas do not force you. Everything comes out of your own efforts in the way. It goes to a part of how we train and how we structure our temples and how we look at things. We tend to just emphasize sitting still and allowing people to do what they think is best. And so we don't have like the praise band, and we don't have really charismatic speakers who are trying to get people to come and, you know, provide entertainment for people. We really take this idea of not forcing people to that extent, where we're even kind of boring, in a certain respect. My apologies. I'm trying not to be too boring, but if you see what I'm getting at, we just really want to have people understand that it is completely voluntary. Practice is completely voluntary. It's completely up to you. And this can be a little bit difficult, actually, for some people, because we really try to respect people's kind of space and their will and their own voluntary action in the Dharma. So we're not out there kind of calling you up on the phone and saying, how you doing? When you come in for whatever, you know, it's really just, here's our offering. Here is what we're doing. If you wish to come and join us, please do. We're delighted if you come, but we're not going to have any kind of emotional arm twisting, however subtle or positive it is. And again, that can be quite difficult for people because it really makes us stand on our own two feet. It makes us really stand on our own intention to train. This is a deeply important characteristic of practice. Deeply important because I tend to be the sort of person who will kind of reach out and kind of latch on to people, kind of unwittingly, and try to be dragged along by them. But for myself, I've recognized that actually creates suffering for myself. So I am deeply grateful for a tradition which says, yeah, you got to do it. You know, you have to make the running. You have to go. When you train, you are beckoning to enlightenment. When we sit down, we're basically kind of running up the flag and saying, hey, Buddha, look at me. Please help me. I want to know what's true. And this is something we need to kind of recognize, because the Buddha will listen to us. We will have a response to that. When we train, we're beckoning to enlightenment. We're saying, please come and inform my life. And that is a thing that is quite real. That is something that we we can experience and recognize in our own life. Your own treasure is within you, not outside. Again, we have what it takes. We actually do have what it takes, even though we may feel completely inadequate about it. It's not a good example, but lately I've been kind of walking around and I think, oh God, you're such an idiot. For whatever reason. I don't even know sometimes, but I think, do I really have what it takes? It's not like I feel completely, I feel inadequate so much, but there's some kind of little subtle thing there kind of going, I don't know, Reverend Leon. And I just have to kind of keep going, okay, well, I'll let that go. I'm just going to keep going forward one step at a time and not really be deterred by that kind of voice of doubt, that voice of inadequacy, that sense of, well, is this really good? My own treasure is within me. And when I really make an effort to just sit still during those arising of difficult states of mind, something really shifts. Something really changes. The treasure house is that willingness to just keep putting the teaching into practice. Just keep sitting still. Isn't that interesting? Just sit still. I was thinking along those lines the other day, and I was thinking, oh, isn't that interesting? I'll just really be, just sit still and sit still and sit still. And then I was feeling kind of grumpy and then sit still, really put in a little effort into that. And then Rinpoche comes home from his walk, and we start talking, and I realize, oh, I'm actually in kind of a good mood now. It was kind of weird. And I didn't really notice in my mind the transition, except that I had been working on just letting go of that mind and not really trying to get rid of it. I try to be as kind to my insecurities as I can be when they're there, and you know, just sit still with it, and yet there is a noticeable transition that happens. There's a noticeable change that I can kind of look back on and think, oh, yeah, something is different now. Okay, that is really our own treasure house. Training and enlightenment are their own reward. Again, there just isn't any. I remember thinking to myself, you know, someone could offer me $1 million or whatever for the effort that I have put in to do my training over the last however long it's been. And I would have to say, no thanks. I want this. I want this effort. I want the result of this effort. It really is intangible. I can't really say what it means. I'm not, you know, I'm just not a great person. I'm not really the great, wonderful person or anything like that. Just, it's really made a tangible, noticeable difference in my life. That much I can say and know that that's true. Okay, enlightened action leaves no sign by which it can be traced. Again, I can't really kind of point to something and say, oh yeah, I have, my IQ points have gone up by X, Y, or Z, and my heart rate has gone down, however many beats per minute or anything like that. There isn't really a quantifiable thing that I can point to that training has given me. And yet, I keep thinking, you know, this is the most precious thing in my life. It's kind of a mystery to me how that can be. And yet, there it is. To look back on one's training with enlightened eyes is to see no speck of dust. To look for such a thing is the same as trying to see a white cloud at the distance of 10,000 miles. When encompassing training and enlightenment, no single speck of dust can be trodden upon. Should we do so, heaven and earth would collapse. But in returning to our true home, we are transcending the status of the Buddha. When we look at our life from the point of view of non-discrimination, from the point of view of meditation, when we look back on our life, we see in the sense that when we look at our life from that point of view, we recognize I have been doing the best that I can. I have been doing as good as I could possibly do. When we look at our life from that perspective, there isn't a blemish. There isn't a thing where we can say, that was bad. There might be some things that we look at and think, boy, it would have been good if I'd done that differently. But there isn't an unclarity, an unworthiness, something like that. There's just this sense of compassion and the sense of, okay, I've done the best that I could. And this is a great... this is a great value. And from this perspective of returning to our true home, this is what we're looking for when we're seeking the way, our own true home within our own body and mind. When we see our life from that perspective, we are just an ordinary person. And yet we have, in a really... in a significant way, we have gone beyond the idea of what a Buddha is. We have transcended the status of a Buddha. We have made the life of Buddha real in this particular time, at this particular moment. And that is really what Shakyamuni Buddha did. He was just himself. He was just a human being. And he put the Dharma into practice in his life. And in that sense, took his life beyond the status of normal human being and beyond the status of being a Buddha, some idealized form of a Buddha. He made the Buddha's teaching real. He himself made the Buddha's teaching real. And that's what we can do. That's what we do every day when we get up and slog through our day and, you know, kind of do our little meditation in the morning. That's what we're doing. We're actually transcending the ideals of Buddhism. We are transcending the scriptures. We are transcending that kind of formalized notion of Buddhism, and we're putting it into practice, we're making it real for ourselves. This is a very profound matter. Okay, well, that's the end of those sections. Mm-hmm. Any questions?
What was the part about treading on a piece of dust?
When encompassing training and enlightenment, no single speck of dust can be trodden upon. Should we do so, heaven and earth would collapse, but in returning to our true home, we transcend the status of the Buddha. That's a good question. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I didn't completely understand what you asked.
Just to repeat it.
Well, no, but I don't understand what it means to tread on. Just if we tread on a piece of dust, we're going to like destroy the universe.
It gets into judgmentalism, is my understanding. In other words, if we see, okay, I did this thing, and therefore I can't, you know, I'm unworthy. I can't find the Buddha nature. I can't find enlightenment. I can't find the truth. That's trotting on this piece of dust. That's making it real. That's seeing an obstacle in your life. Yeah, you may have done some things which are unfortunate, regrettable, cause much suffering for yourself and others. And those are the very things that got you where you are right now. And so not only are they not obstacles, but they are the very things that have brought you to where you are so that you can open yourself to the truth. And if you use those, this is my understanding, if you use those as an excuse not to train, oh, well, there's this speck of dust or this molehill or this mountain, you know, I you know, set up concentration camps, you know, whatever it is there, you know, whatever it is in your past history, whether in this life or another, and so therefore it's not possible for me to train, then you've just, how does he destroy?
So heaven and earth would collapse.
You know, because you've put yourself outside of the Buddha Dharma, you put yourself outside of the ability to train. And if you see those things truly as the what can be used and what has been used to get you where you are, however may uncomfortable it may be, nevertheless, in opening you to the Buddha Dharma, then that's the wonderful thing about samsara. That's the beauty about samsara, is it works to our advantage if we sit still and look up.
Yeah. So kind of this this image is you when you make that speck of dust real and step on it, then you've in a sense sort of crystallized the world into something that is quite breakable. Because you kind of have, you've made that dust, that event real, and all the consequences are crystallized, they've solidified, and because it was wrong and you stepped on it, it's kind of broken the whole thing apart. But there's a quality of training in which we're kind of going forward in meditation in which everything is quite fluid. Everything is actually quite, is not fixed, is quite malleable and workable, however it goes forward. It's when we solidify things in our mind, when we make it, it's this way and it's bad, or it's this way and it's good, we set ourselves up for basically a breakdown, the collapse of heaven and earth. If that makes sense. We set ourselves up for the breaking of a situation. And so when we can kind of go forward in this, in the mind of meditation, which is just kind of, you know, letting things come and go and letting go and letting go, then it's different it's just different than our mind, which wants to kind of solidify it and make it into a solid kind of place or a solid kind of experience. Does that make some sense?
Both of your explanations make sense, but how you got there from that sense, I have no idea.
That's interesting.
That's part of a longer familiarity with Dogen.
Yeah.
Because when I read that sentence, none of what you said occurred to me at all.
Yeah.
I am so incredibly literal, I honestly think he's talking about stepping on a piece of dust.
Yeah.
And how that does what the end of the sentence describes makes, you know, it's just not there.
Yeah.
For me.
Right. Well, again, if, you know, for you, maybe it would just be useful to just kind of start off, or when you read a sentence like that and it kind of goes, what? You know, kind of just start off by saying, okay, literal mind, this is not, he's not talking about this literally. Or at least, maybe it's possible that he's not. What could this mean in terms of how, what his metaphor is, how he's talking about this? What can this tell me about the nature of life and the way that Dogen thinks? You know, and it's just what Rimas Rokusan is talking about, just a familiarity with how Dogen thinks and how we can kind of try to follow along in the way that he thinks.
Part of it for me is when I read Dogen, I don't try to make it make sense. Now, there are people, my understanding is there are people who do, but for me it doesn't work. I just read the words and let them have whatever effect they have. And over time, I don't do it a lot. I don't read Dogen a lot. But over time, there is a certain entrance. That's how one becomes more familiar with. And there are places where he tends to explain himself a little more. Mm-hmm. And so the more you read, the more he will throw in his own explanations. And there are times when it almost seems as if his intention is to be obscure, because that helps, potentially, because that helps one to let go of one's grasping mind, of one's intellectual mind. I'm not sure that's what's going on, but I've heard people say that, and for me, that makes a certain amount of sense. So, you know, I just don't try to read Dogen with anything like an analysis. Mm-hmm. That's not helpful for me.
Well, like the earlier part about, you know, the analogy of like, you're not going to get wealthy if you don't work hard and study. Mm-hmm. Well, you're not going to get to enlightenment if you don't work hard mm-hmm. and study. Mm-hmm. That, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
That seems fairly straightforward. Or maybe it isn't, I don't know, but to me it seems fairly straightforward. So it's like some of the stuff seems understandable, and then some of the stuff is like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The analogy that occurred to me is the scriptures use the word immaculate a lot. Uh-huh. There's immaculate, and dust to me implies non-immaculate.
Right.
And so.
Yeah, it's true. That's a important thing. There's an idea in which we need to be able to see that dust is immaculate, and I think in a way that's what Dogen is kind of pointing at here. Part of the thing about reading Dogen and encountering Buddhism is that there are some things which are fairly straightforward and understandable to our minds. Because actually, I would suspect that if we looked at the past lives, forgive me for saying it, of all of you, there's been some encounter with Buddhism in the past. Some wish to practice, some actual experience of practicing in past existences. And that gives you a particular type of basis for understanding practice. And that gives you merit, which is bearing fruit, and which bears fruit as a way to understand practice for each person. And so some things about the Dharma will be somewhat understandable to us, and some things will not be. They will be opaque. And one of the challenges of someone like Dogen, he was really deeply enlightened. You know, he really deeply understood the Dharma from the perspective of his own experience, from his own realization of enlightenment, his own realization of deep practice. And that was partly probably due to his, I mean, he was kind of a monk since he was, like, what, 7 or 10 or something like that, for up until he died at age 54. And I'm sure that, for him, in past existences, he had been practitioner of the Dharma. So he was really kind of into Buddhism and kind of deeply steeped in it. He knew a lot. And sometimes what he says to us addresses where we are at present, addresses our present understanding, and we can kind of understand what that means. And then sometimes he's going to give us something that's just a little bit beyond our present understanding, and that's going to kind of help us to take another step in our own deepening of understanding. Sometimes he might not be talking to us in particular, but someone else who's way more advanced than us, and he'll say something which is completely mind-boggling. Maybe he'll say something which is completely mind-boggling to everyone. And that, again, is to kind of point out there are these kind of profound different levels of understanding and practice. There are these profound aspects of practice. And as we go along, that will make a difference for us. That will eventually come to our use. And by just exposing ourselves to them without really necessarily kind of understanding what they mean intellectually, it also plants a seed and helps us in the future. All right, any other thoughts or questions? Well, thank you.